Good morning. Thank you all for being here. Great is the matter of birth and death. Life slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Wake up. Wake up. Don't waste a moment. It's interesting to me that these words are where they are in this temple. Traditionally, they're written on the door to the Zendo, or on the Han, where you see them mainly as you enter. Here, they're on the pillar opposite the Zendo entrance. I don't know if this was a conscious decision or if that was the only convenient place to put them. But you see them mainly as you leave the Zendo. And in any case, it's certainly appropriate for a lay sangha that we are reminded as we leave the Zendo and get ready to go out into the world. This morning, the beginning of the Shila Ango, we've installed the Bodhisattva Kanon on the altar. Kanon is the Bodhisattva of great compassion. Shila is an opportunity to explore our own compassionate nature, which is really just another word for Buddha nature. To explore this within ourselves, our family, loved ones, with friends, acquaintances, with strangers, and ultimately, even with sworn enemies. For in Shila, there is self and other. Virtue and compassion only happen when we relate with people, animals, and things. In our most intense practice form, says Shin, we spend about 10 hours a day sitting. That leaves 14 hours a day in which we are not sitting. What do we do with them? Out of session, we sit here at the center maybe 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 hours a week. If we're conscientious, we may sit an hour or so a day at home. What do we do with all the rest of that time? Great is the matter of birth and death. Life slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Wake up, wake up. Don't waste a moment. As many of you know, my mother died just over a month ago. And Mike's mother died just a couple of days ago. It's an indication of the aging of the Sangha that our parents are starting to leave us. After my mother died, I stood by the bed in that nursing home for a long time. It was not a terrible sight. It was, like her passing, very peaceful. And yet there was the undeniable fact of death, the end of a cycle, the turning of the wheel, birth and death. My mother was not a Zen practitioner. She didn't do Zazen the way we do it, but she did do a certain amount of meditation with a local non-sectarian group. And she did think about her own death quite a bit. And she faced it squarely, without any attempt at denial. The last time I visited her was a little over a year ago. And as I was leaving, she said very matter-of-factly, "Well, I probably won't see you again." And she was right. It was that kind of upfront, no-holds-barred honesty that is my most treasured memory of her. I never knew her to try to dissemble or spin what she felt was the truth of something. She was, all her life, a woman of quiet integrity. She raised 2 sons, one of whom was a real handful, as a single mom, at a time when divorce was not considered okay. At the same time, she became a highly respected member of her profession. She spent some 40 years teaching piano. When she retired, it was full of honors from her professional organizations. In the last 2 or 3 years, as she became more and more aware of her own decline, the memory loss, inability to call up words, and especially the loss of her independence. She grew impatient, irritated, but never fearful. Once she said, "I don't understand why I can't just turn off a switch." At the end, in the late stage of what we think was Alzheimer's, she just faded away. She stopped breathing on the morning of Sunday, November 30th. In remembering all this, it occurred to me that none of us has any real control over how we die. Certainly my mother would rather have gone much more quickly. We all cherish the dream of death with dignity, that's the current buzz phrase. We think of dying at home or possibly in a well-run hospice, without pain, surrounded by loved ones, fully conscious to the end. An exceedingly rare occurrence. Dying is much more likely to be painful, terrifying, messy, and humiliating. Anything from a sudden heart attack in a public place or an automobile accident or a plane crash to a long, agonizing bout with cancer or just garden variety heart failure. Dying is a lonely business and most often happens in the impersonal surroundings of an intensive care unit with tubes and wires in every orifice. We make whatever arrangements we can, but in the end, there is no control. So, how we die in the last days or weeks of a terminal illness or condition is far less important than how we die over the last 10, 20, or 40 years of our lives. What is really important is to live life in such a way that if we die tomorrow or in the next minute, we can face it whatever the circumstances. And those who meet death well are those who have thought long and seriously about it, as my mother certainly did. For those of us here, that comes as a natural part of doing a lot of Zazen. I can't imagine anybody practicing for any length of time who doesn't begin to think seriously about their own death. It's a subject that just naturally comes up as the mind settles. The other side is how we live in the world, to comport ourselves so that at any moment we can look back without shame. In Zen, the emphasis tends to be on enlightenment, wisdom. But how that wisdom functions in our daily lives is the real test. I believe that my mother was able to look back without any regret or shame. We should all live so well. Chela is the opportunity to practice our lives, to engage in our daily living in the world with honesty and with honor. And all this in the face of death that can happen at any moment. At the end of each sitting, we get up, walk to the door, place our hands in gassho, step across the threshold, and there it is. Great is the matter of birth and death. Life slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Wake up, wake up. Don't waste a moment. Don't waste a moment in or out of the Zendo. Obviously, we can't stay in the Zendo indefinitely. But it's not good to leave it either. Not in the usual sense of, well, now the sitting's over and I'll get on with my day. So where's the middle way? In Sesshin, we enlarge the Zendo to include the entire building. Practice in Sesshin does not cease at the door of the Zendo. Out of Sesshin, we have to enlarge the Zendo to include the whole world. Practice cannot cease at the door of the temple. And how do we do that? Is practice out in the world the same as practice in the Zendo? In comparing monastic life to the world, Thomas Merton quoted the Marxist dictum, "From each according to ability, to each according to need." Merton's comment on that saying was that is indeed how it works in a monastery. but not in the world. Well, it certainly doesn't happen in the world, not as we generally know it. But I think that it does begin to happen in the world as one continues in their practice. From each according to ability. In a monastery, each member of the community contributes his or her very best they have to offer, not just as work for food or shelter, certainly not for money, but as an offering. Shila is the opportunity to look at our work in the world, at our jobs, our work at home, whatever volunteer work we do. Work as offering, as dana, offering to our families, those that we care for. Work as offering to others, our colleagues and our co-workers, doing the best we can, because it is what we are doing at this moment. When we work in this way, the question of reward or payback recedes. It becomes less important. It's okay to get paid. In fact, it's a necessity, but not to get hung up on it. One who works only for the money is truly in hell. To each according to the need. In a monastery, each member of the community receives what they need, and only what they need. Food, clothing, shelter, tools, and a space to work when needed. Extra care if ill. Shila is the opportunity to look at what we think of as our needs. The notion of need changes radically according to circumstances. In the affluent society, it might include such things as entertainment centers and shoes that light up at night. To a homeless person, it's the next meal. I'm not advocating asceticism here, but consider, how many pairs of shoes can we wear at one time? How many rooms can we occupy at one time? How many cars can we drive? How many coats can we wear? How much food can we eat at one sitting? In a monastery, everything is received as a gift, with deepest gratitude. It has nothing to do with payment for services. Even if one has prepared the meal, it is eaten with gratitude. If one has sewn one's own clothing, it is worn with gratitude. Shila is an opportunity to examine how we receive. This is a question that's sometimes ignored. We are constantly adjured to give, and rightly so, but we also receive constantly. Receiving is the other half of dana. Without someone to receive, there can be no giving. When we receive something that's obviously a gift, as we generally do around this time of year, it's easy to express and feel gratitude. But what about that paycheck? Do we receive that with equal gratitude? Or is it with a grudging acceptance and wishing there was more? Do we examine the motives of the giver? What's he expecting from me? Where's the catch? How often is the appreciation of a generous act by someone contaminated, defiled by our own opinion of that person? Shila is the opportunity to practice giving without question, receiving with gratitude our paycheck, a sunrise, a rebuke from our teacher, or an insult from a stranger. When we place a donation in the box in the foyer, or a Salvation Army kettle, or give to anyone, not questioning where the money will go, no demand for an accounting, it is kanon that moves us. Each time we receive with simple gratitude, it is kanon that moves us. Each time, kanon saves us and the other, giver and receiver. To save one is to save the other. They are not separate. Shila is the opportunity to become completely simple in our own actions and in how we view the actions of others. Whatever we do is an offering. Whatever we receive is a gift. Cause and effect do not enter in. To live this way in the world is to live as the Bodhisattva. The most intense examples of this way of being are in the Jataka tales. These are stories of the Buddha before he became the Buddha, but lived many lives as a bodhisattva. They are sometimes thought of as teaching stories for children. Far from it. It's important for all of us to look at these stories carefully. The Buddha, in one life as a prince, allowed himself to be eaten by a tigress so that she and her cubs would not starve. In another life as a rabbit, he throws himself into a fire to provide a meal for a beggar. In yet another, he cuts the flesh from his own legs to feed an injured hawk. This is the ultimate in non-separation. Such acts are possibly only with complete and total non-separation. And in that case, they're not at all difficult. They're just a thing to do. One part of a single body will stint at nothing to help another part. But with the slightest hint of you and I, self and other, they are utterly impossible. And if such an act does happen, it's ineffective because it's being done for the wrong reasons. Even slight distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. Saints on. The slightest difference between you and the way will be a greater separation than heaven and earth. Dogen. These examples are probably not meant to be taken literally, but they show us something. They show us where we really are. By comparison, we tend in our thinking to kind of tippy-toe around things, around our practice and our concepts about compassion. How much more is compassion than writing that quarterly check to Oxfam? Not that writing the check is a bad thing. It's wonderful. Whatever we do in that way is wonderful. We all do the best we can, but let's keep it in perspective. The most remarkable example of this kind of practice, a current example, is provided for us by Bernie Glassman. Glassman is the Dharma heir of Maizumi Roshi of the Los Angeles Zen Center. For many years now, he has conducted what he calls street retreats in New York's Bowery and other cities in Europe and America. His requirements to join such a retreat are very simple. First, you have to raise just over $3,000 and give it to him. But you can't just write a check. You can't use your own money. You have to beg all that money from friends, family, strangers, anybody who will give you something. Then you live on the street for 5 days without money. Glassman describes all this in an extraordinary book entitled Bearing Witness. In that book he writes, "When we go to the Bowery to bear witness to life on the streets, we are offering ourselves, not blankets, not food, not clothes, just ourselves. We put away the things we identify with, watches, jewelry, money, credit cards. We go with the clothes on our backs, nothing more. For the first street retreats, I permitted people to carry $2 a day for emergency money. Now we carry no money." This book had the same effect on me as reading those Jataka tales I mentioned earlier. It brings up the question of what it is to really be a bodhisattva. Does it require our bringing stuff? Should Glassman and his colleagues go to the Bowery with blankets and food? Or is all that stuff a kind of armor that would separate him from the real life of the streets? By stripping himself bare, except for the clothes on his back, he forces himself to enter fully into that life. No reservation, nothing held back, not knowing that he's a Zen master or activist or anything else to get in the way. This kind of practice may not be for everyone, but even just reading and thinking about it is to raise doubts about our old comfortable paradigms about the nature of compassion, who we are. It puts us at the edge of our practice. Raising this doubt puts us into the condition of not knowing. And this is the vital point. The only way we can enter fully, unreservedly, into our lives is in the condition of not knowing. Glassman writes, "No matter what we think, we are never in control and things will happen as they happen. But in a state of unknowing, we actually live without attachment to preconceived ideas. There is no expectation of gain, no expectation of loss. There's just what's here right now." Shila is the opportunity to see how this not knowing functions in our lives, to embrace the unexpected with no preconceptions, to take a deep breath, let everything go, and let what happens happen. Let the 10,000 things confirm the self every moment. Now, all this talk about not knowing may sound a little strange from someone who has spent his entire adult life teaching science, human biology. But it's not so strange, really. In fact, it is said that the Buddha insisted that religion must be in accord with what is known scientifically. Otherwise, it degenerates into superstition, that most pernicious form of knowing. Not knowing is very much a part of the scientific outlook. A scientific mind is the one that looks carefully at each belief, each assumption, each knowing, and says, "Let's look at this a little more carefully. Let's test this a little more rigorously." In the scientific outlook, nothing, no result, no theory is ever fixed or permanent. When an experiment or a test doesn't pan out, the investigator just says, "Well, I need to look at this in a different way. Maybe set it aside for a while, try something else." The times when science fails is when there's an attachment to a theory or idea, when too much is known. It cripples thought and creativity. It becomes defensive. Over the years, I've seen normally rational practitioners of scientific research fall again and again into that trap. Massive scientific, political, cultural, ethical, religious disputes all come from this knowing. I think it was Yasutani Roshi who said once that when a dispute continues for any length of time, all sides are wrong. Lately, I've been involved in a number of controversies and disputes where I work. And my immediate reaction to these things is to believe the first story I hear. And then I hear somebody else's version of what happened. And it's like news from another planet. And they're all good people. No one's lying. Nobody's trying to deceive. It's very strange, but I feel more and more that there really is no such thing as objective truth. There is only your truth and my truth. And to hang on to one's own truth is just as much an attachment as any other. Resolution comes only when someone decides to let go of his or her truth. This can be very painful. It takes some humility and even courage. Shila is the opportunity to let go of this knowing, specious truth, to see our clinging to the truths of this world and let go of them. Can we see what we think of as the dearest truths about ourselves, about others, even about practice, and let them go? Turning back to death. Death is the ultimate in letting go, and we will all do it, ready or not, whether we want to or not. The letting go of things, the letting go of knowing, is the practice of dying. Letting go of all those notions around birth, death, giving, receiving, knowing, identity, being, each moment is an opportunity if we're awake to it. The 16th century essayist Michel de Montaigne wrote, "When death waits for us, where death waits for us is uncertain. Let us look for him everywhere. The premeditation of death is the premeditation of liberty. He who has learned to die has unlearned to serve. There is nothing of evil in life for him who rightly comprehends that the privation of life is no evil. to know how to die delivers us from all subjugation and constraint. Shila is entering fully into the cycle with no reservation, nothing held back. Nothing is held back any more than in our mu on the mat, or our breathing, or counting, or just sitting. We enter into this cycle, not in any theoretical or sanitized way. It is entering into the pain, sorrow, loss, joy, fun, blood, sweat, and tears of our lives, and the impermanence of everything. Jung Cha writes, "Many births, many deaths. I am serene in this cycle. There is no end to it." Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.